Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Detroit, began selling drugs at age 9, and murdered an innocent man in 1992. While serving 12 years in prison, 6 of which were in solitary confinement, he transformed his life by reading over 1,300 books. Today, he's the author of 3 books, regularly appears on many national TV shows, and counsels at-risk youth. His name? Raphael Johnson. And we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Raphael Johnson, who's the owner and CEO of Total Package Lifestyle LLC and has a most unbelievable journey in life. Raphael, welcome. An honor to have you.
Thank you so much, Jack. It's an honor to be here.
Can you talk about your childhood and your mom?
I grew up in the city of Detroit. My story is pretty much no different than up to probably 76% of the young people in the urban communities who grew up without their father. My father made some very poor decisions that landed him in prison, more importantly, away from the family. So I grew up with a single-parent household with my mother and my 2 sisters. And my mother, although she worked extremely hard to try to provide a blueprint of success for the children, she kept us neat, she kept us orderly and clean. There was still that rebellious spirit that I had that we see so prevalent in so many of the young boys today who are in a single parent home, and I end up, you know, seeking solace and comfort and that bonding, that male bonding, from the individuals who were in my neighborhood.
At age 9, you started selling drugs.
That's true.
Talk to us about your life from 9 to 17.
Well, you know, without a male role model in the household, number one, and very few in the community, it's easy for young men to want to be associated with what they render as strength, what they render as bonding, what they render as family, as a unit. Hence, where you have gangs, crews, and cliques here in the city of Detroit and all over the country. And I was no different. You know, I wanted solace. I wanted a validation from the guys. It's like, you know, some of the things that we see in the sports, the validation we see from team players. The same type of mentality, the same concept applies in the street as well. And so, when I didn't have that, it's easy for individuals, especially like myself, to seek it inside the street. So I wanted to be tough. I wanted to be respected. I think that's what we see today. I wanted to be validated. And so, you know, it was a young man who I saw in my neighborhood who was selling drugs and doing the best that they can to get by that I looked up to. And so my 15 and 16 year old neighbors were the ones who originally introduced me to crack cocaine when I was 9 years old, when it first came out in my neighborhood.
Raphael, if a single mom's listening tonight, mm-hmm. and she's got a couple of sons that she's worried about, mm-hmm. you know, that are 15 years old and they're, you know, inching down that wrong path, mm-hmm. what can she do?
It's very critical. She knows, and she must know, that she cannot take the place of the father. It's impossible. She can be a strong mother. She can be adamant. She can be disciplined. But at the end of the day, those young men have to see positive male role models. They have to. Seeing is believing. What we see has more of a precept than what we hear. Sight travels at the rate of 186,000 miles per second. Sound, 1,120 feet per second. So again, what we see have more of a precept than what we hear. They can hear about being a good man and doing right by your family and being right by your community. But if they don't see that, then it won't have a profound effect as if they would visually see that. So that's the first thing. They have to be around men who are doing something, who have a greater impact than young Jock, than little Jeezy, than young Wayne, than anybody else who is capturing their attention but not really giving them substance. They need to be around men who stand up for their community, who are leaving a legacy, who are out here fighting a good fight and may not be making a whole lot of money, may not be driving the fancy cars, but at the end of the day, they can say, I am a man. I am a man. This is what I did in the service of other people, because guess what? This is what men do. They need to see that.
Let's go back to November 21st, 1992, mm-hmm. a day that altered your life and other people's lives
forever.
Forever.
Absolutely.
Please.
I was at a party with three other friends who were 16 and 17 years old, who also went to the University of Detroit Jesuit High School as I did. Once we got inside the party, we became engaged in a playful tussle that stemmed over a piece of cake. This was misconstrued by the chaperones or bouncers, if you will, as a fight or a disturbance in the least. As a result, we were escorted and thrown out of the building. Once we got outside the building, the chaperones, you know, continued to do what they were supposed to do. In hindsight, you know, they were supposed to make sure that we were away from the building, since it was obvious that we presented to be a nuisance inside. One of the chaperones, however, took it upon himself to strike me, knock me down to the ground. I was arrogant, you know, as a young man. I was egotistical, you know. I was the alpha of my friends, you know, and so I was embarrassed. But more importantly, I was emotional, and the emotions that overcame me allowed me to go and rationalize in my mind to go get a handgun and come back and settle the score. And so the man that I've never seen, his name is Mr. Johnny Havard, never heard, never touched me, end up getting killed, and I was responsible for that. I was 17 years old, and you know, that was somebody's son, somebody's father, somebody's uncle, somebody's brother. And as you just indicated, it's something that I will never forget as long as I live. I mean, it was literally half my life ago, but I still think about that. It's a motivating factor, because Mr. Johnny Havard lives through me. And the work that I'm doing, some people think I'm crazy, going after individuals who commit crimes against women, children, and senior citizens. That's none of your business. That's their business. That ain't got nothing to do with you. Well, it has a whole lot to do with Raphael B. Johnson, because that young man who committed that horrific crime, senseless crime, that's a senseless crime, he's no longer here. But there's a new improved person who understands that young man, understands more importantly the victim, Mr. Johnny Havard. So I carry two people with me today.
Raphael, does a day ever go by that you don't think about November 21st, 92?
Not one day.
Does an hour ever go by?
Not an hour.
A minute?
Not a minute.
Wow.
Everything that I am and everything that I strive to be and the better person that I'll become tomorrow is deeply rooted in the loss of life of Mr. Johnny Havard. That's just how it is. I can't explain the psychodynamics of it. I can't explain the medical or the social. I can't explain either. I can just explain to you what I'm feeling as a man that sit right here in front of you. That's the motivating factor. And by the grace of God, it's allowed me to reach beyond the depths of individuals who probably could not have been reached had not someone can experience or has experienced what they've been through.
When we come back, we'll ask Raphael Johnson about the 12 years he spent in prison, 6 of which in solitary confinement. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Raphael Johnson, who murdered an innocent man on November 21st, 1992, and spent 12 years in incarceration prison, 6 of which in solitary confinement. Raphael, why were you in solitary confinement, and what was that like?
I was in solitary confinement up under what is called a notice of intent, which is an administrative move that prison officials can make without an individual prisoner actually engaging in some type of infraction of prison rules. It's the more intensified and extensive form of classification, because again, the policy does not mandate that an individual have to commit an infraction. I was literally seen as a threat. Most prison officials will come forward now today, you know, years later, and say that I was a threat. I went to school, and most prisoners don't finish school. I had a little intelligence. And I was disciplined, and so people followed me. And so anytime that you have an individual, and I can understand from their rationale, who have droves of individuals that will follow and listen, that person can become a threat. But more importantly, if I'm getting individuals off the gambling tables and prohibiting them from stabbing each other over 10-cent tone soap or a 20-cent ramen noodle, and get them to get their GEDs and strive for higher education, and more importantly, change their ways and change their thinking, they won't come back to prison. If they don't want to come back to prison, then guess what? Somebody will be out of a job. So it was more like a job security. So I spent 6 years in solitary confinement. I am not angry. I am not bitter. Those years literally shaped me. It reminded me of a quote from Charles Dickens out of A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. And I looked at my incarceration in that particular instance. I've never laughed as much in my life than in there, and I never cried as much in my life than I did in there. I've seen a lot. I've seen individuals lose their lives. I've seen suicides. But more importantly, I had to take a real in-depth look at myself. And that's the only situation that I know of in life where a man is forced to deal with internal difficulties and the internal struggles that most human beings spend a lifetime trying to overcome, but never. It shaped me. In a quote from Nelson Mandela, where he said, "My isolation has afforded me a great deal of clarity." I understand that now, because my isolation in solitary confinement in Michigan's maximum security has definitely afforded me a great deal of clarity. And more importantly, it has given me an understanding of my purpose and my mission in life.
Speaking of Nelson Mandela, he spent 27 years in prison.
Right.
And then at his inauguration, when he became president of the country, at a place of honor on the stage, he had all of the former guards come.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. That's impossible. How do you explain that?
Well, you know, good or bad, the purpose of life is evolution. The only way that you can grow, the only way that you can evolve, is through the experiences and all the expressions that life forges in your path. That means the people who did you wrong, the people who snarled at you, the people who committed acts of injustice upon you, they're all a part of the equation of your growth. So that in itself says, you know what, I'm not bitter, I'm not angry, because you have made me into the person that I am today. You have helped contribute to the moral fibers and the principles and the codes of honor that I hold today. I am not mad at you, because you were used for that particular time for a reason. You are part of the equation of my makeup. So it's not I get all the good people who done me right. No. All the bad people, too. All the people who didn't have their best interests at heart are part of the equation of you growing and reaching the epitome of where you're at now.
Raphael, was there someone that you met while in prison that you would like to go back and meet again?
I met a lot of individuals. And although I can't pinpoint one now at this very moment, if I had time, I can think. But those who I've met were some very genuine people who at some point in their lives made some poor decisions and rendered themselves incarcerated for the rest of their natural lives, rendered themselves incarcerated for 200 to 400 years based on a very poor decision. There are a lot of Raphael B. Johnsons in prison. I'm just one that the community knows so much about because of the attention. But there's so many Raphael B. Johnsons that are lingering inside those prison walls. I've never seen more talent in life than I've seen with the men inside prison. Never seen it. I've seen men make a remote control out of a deck of playing cards and a wire out of a hearing speaker. I mean, I've seen so much. I've seen them take mirrors and make artwork that would probably go for thousands of dollars here in the community. And it's sad, because you have to go through all those circumstances and of course victimizing someone else before you come into those untapped reservoir of skills and talents inside the system.
Raphael Johnson, you're the founder of the 180 degree program.
That's right.
Which teaches at-risk students conflict resolution, anger management, problem solving, character development, violence prevention, drug prevention, and fitness training. You've worked with over 1,000 DPS students.
And more than that.
What's your basic message to those kids?
Our message is don't give up. I had a staff training earlier this week, and we went review some case studies, actual students. And what we found is these young people are hurting. Young girls are being impregnated by their own fathers, molested. Young boys are seeing their fathers beat their mothers up. It's a plethora of pain that exists with our DPS students. Politics is not going to get it. whoever is in the seat of controlling the DPS is not going to get it. It's going to take a culture shock. One thing that's never stressed in any of the curriculums, and we have been very successful, is the other 16 hours. You have 8 hours of school, approximately 8 hours, and you can talk about getting these children in classrooms and trying to give them assessments and tests and trying to bring their grades up. But if you never discuss the other 16 hours outside of school, going past the crack house, going past the 80,000 vacant homes, dealing with individuals at the gas stations, at the corner stores, dealing with STDs, dealing with the prevalence of violence that has become the pop culture, the subculture in this city. You can never get these children to do right academically. You must help them with life skills that's going to help them cope with those issues the other 16 hours. Surely 16 hours has always been greater than 8 hours, no matter how you look at that. And since the 16 hours are greater than the 8 hours, then we have to make sure that these young people know how to properly deal with the other 16 hours outside of schools. Until then, we'll continue to have poor failing system. We'll continue to have grades that are low. We'll continue not to meet AYP. We'll continue to send out and 12th grade individuals who are not qualified for the real world. That's the key. The other 16 hours. No one has talked about that.
If you want to learn more, www.the180program.us.
That's right.
www.the180program.us. Some would say, Raphael, who are you to tell others how to live?
I am no one to tell anyone how to live. But what I can do, I am someone to give you a few components about life and decision making. I am one with the minimum of experience and the little intelligence that I have that can tell you that I've been around the block. And if going around the block, I've been there, and I tell you don't go around there, trust me, you should trust me not to go that way. I am one with experience. Experience is much more better than degrees. I have the degrees, of course, but I have the experience. And so, again, I'm no one to tell anyone else to how to live, but I am someone to invite them to change because I've seen both sides of the fence, and one side is much better than the other.
For everyone that you reach and listens to you, there's many more that don't listen to you. Does that get you down?
Not at all. You know, I was told by a wise man that life is about polarities and balance. For every person that loves you, there's going to be a person that hates you. For every person that you're able to reach, there's going to be one that you're not going to be able to reach. That's something that I've already considered. To be a leader means understanding that everyone's not going to listen to you. So we don't focus on those who are not going to listen. We focus on those who are attentive and who can learn and grow from what you have to share with them.
We're talking to Raphael Johnson, and I'm Jack Krasulin, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back. I'm Jack Krasula. We're with Raphael Johnson. Raphael, in the earlier segment, you talked about this subculture. Mm. How do we change that subculture in our inner cities?
It goes back to the question you asked about the woman and the two boys, this scenario. They have to see it. We have so many proponents in our community that have evaded the moral fibers of our community. And I mean where little girls can't even walk down the street without being raped, without being groped and sexually assaulted by grown men, where grandmothers can't grow to be 80 and 90 years old without having someone break in their homes and rape them and leave them for dead. We've reached a critical point in our history, and men have to stand up. These atrocities have happened on every man that's living on their watch. And so the challenge to men today is, what legacy do you want to leave behind? What will history say about you in the 21st century? On your watch, while you were living and walking the earth, little girls were being raped and killed. Little girls were being snatched out of their homes and taken to abandoned buildings and raped and had their heads bashed in and then burned alive with 41 cents of gas. That happened on your watch. The challenge to men today is, what legacy are you going to leave behind? The challenge is understanding that you're going to be dead, all of us, much longer than we're going to be alive. And since we're going to be dead much longer than we're going to be alive, that has nothing to do with nobody's religion, philosophical views. That is a natural fact. Since that is a fact, then what we do now is how people remember us. And how are your great-grandchildren will remember you when they look in the history books and saw the atrocities that took place in the city of Detroit and you did nothing? You did nothing but sit on your couch. You did nothing but sit on your porch. You did nothing but ride up and down the street. You pointed the finger, you laid up, and you did nothing. How can you even live with yourself? What kind of legacy? So my thing, in my humble opinion, is that to change the subculture that we see, we have to see men stand up. It was men and women who helped build this city in the 1700s and going into the 1800s.
Let's go back again to November 21st, 92. And it's that morning, and God says, Raphael, here's what's going to happen today. This Johnny Rivard guy is going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to murder him. Your choice. If you want, I won't have you there. What would you tell God?
Wow. Well, I'll ask God if he and I can make a deal that if we can spare Johnny Rivard's life, and if he can allow me to go through every single thing that I would have to go through as a consequence of taking his life, I'll do it. But you got to save him. You got to preserve him.
Unbelievable. The majority of people that go to prison, the recidivism rate 70%+. Your heart changed. You were one of the exceptions. Your heart changed. How did that happen, Raphael Johnson?
Because I'm human. And when you're human, you realize that you committed a grave error that you cannot reverse. When you're human, you operate in the realm of humanities. And you understand that you cannot revisit the things that you could have done better or go back and do the things that you failed to do. But moving forward, you can do some great things. I was tired. So tired became an incentive for change. I saw my situation as an avenue to reach people who were just like me that probably could not be reached. And that's where we at today in 2011, going into 2012. Young people don't want to hear it. They're not going to go to the church. They're not going to go to the mosque. They're not going to go to the library. They're not going to go there. We have to go to them, and we have to be equipped. We are in war. This is literally warfare. And the warfare is not necessarily a physical warfare, but it is a mental warfare. Because thought is the cause of everything. Although thought is immaterial, it is the manifestation of all things in existence. So when you go out there and you look on Jefferson, you look on Dexter, you look on Cass, and you look on Shane, and look up down Grand River, what you see is not just, it just happened out of happenstance. It is the cause, it is the ramifications of a thought process. How can you go get some McDonald's or any other fast food, eat, and then throw out the garbage out on the street? That's a mindset. It's a mindset to be disrespectful. It's a mindset to want to go commit harm and victimize someone who never done anything to you. It's a mindset to say, I'm going to go steal. I don't want to earn my keep. It's a mindset to say, I'm going to lie every chance I get. I'm going to cheat. I'm going to steal. I'm going to ask for handouts. I'm not going to work for my, that's a mindset. The mindset have to be changed. And in order to challenge the thinking, sometimes you got to get on that same level. When you see someone in a hole, you don't go by and say, let me pull you up. No, I literally have to get down in there with you and hoist you up, especially if you're in that hole and you're injured. I cannot pull you up. What if your arm's broke? So me pulling you by your arms out of the hole is irrelevant. I have to get down. I have to hoist you up. And that's the metaphor. That's the exact metaphor that we need in this community. We need men to stand up. And we need men to not pull people up, but hoist people up. He's not heavy. He's my brother.
Raphael Johnson, when your journey on this earth ends, and hopefully you go to eternity, and hopefully I see you up there.
Yes, sir.
And you run into Johnny Rivard, what are you going to say?
In that scenario, I would tell him that what I'm about to say to you is not based on words and lip service, but on the actions and deeds since that very last day that I saw you. And it's easy to say I'm sorry. Anyone can say that, children can say, I'm sorry. But saying sorry and transferring the faith of your sorry to your feet and your hands is two different things. And I hope that the work that I've been doing in the last how many ever years it is a testament to how truly sorry I am for taking your life. And although I've taken your life, I did the first thing that any person should do is I changed my own life. I didn't stop there, but also made a conscious effort to change and effectuate a change in the lives of those people that I came across who were just like me, or even worse. So I hope that as we are in this particular new serene environment, that you can accept my apology, not just because I asked you to, because I believe that I've earned it in trying to save as many lives as I can in your name.
When you pray, what do you say?
I ask God every single night. I thank him for those who are in my life that have made an impact, but I also ask for forgiveness for my sins and my shortcomings. And I ask him to please forgive me if I shall forget or make a mistake. I ask him to please bless the family of Brother Johnny Havar. Bless his mother's heart who passed, whose heart was heavy that her son was taken from her. Bless his family and protect them and look over them. And please protect me in my journey as I continue on this path of trying to save as many lives as I possibly can. Amen.
God is a loving God, a forgiving God.
Mm-hmm.
For many of us, he's forgiven us, but the issue is we can't forgive ourselves. And because mm-hmm. of that, we live in a prison, right? And we're
Absolutely.
A shell of what he wants us to be.
Mm-hmm.
How does somebody learn how to forgive themselves?
I don't know how, I guess it's different strokes for different folks, but I know that Raphael B. Johnson forgave himself. When a complete change overtook me, there's an old aphorism that says that only by true repentance and reform can a person escape the consequences of the evil deeds in which they previously rotted. Only by true repentance and reform, you can be sorry. But if you don't do anything to transfer your sorriness into action, then it's just words and lip service. It's just a fleeting emotion that's conducive for the hour at hand. To forgive yourself, you have to change. Not just you, but you have to do something in the service of other people to help them better themselves and help them live a better quality of life. It's about what you do for yourself. Because again, you can't make anyone do or convince anyone to do something that you haven't done yourself. It starts with self. And then from self, there is the initiative of doing in the service of other people.
We're talking to Raphael Johnson, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with a most extraordinary young man, Raphael Johnson.
Oh, thank you.
Honor to have you.
Honor to be here. Thank you.
Chuck Colson, who's been on the show a couple times, founder of Prison Fellowship,
mm-hmm.
120 countries, 100,000 volunteers, talks about that God's ways are not our ways. And he says, other than that Jewish carpenter from Nazareth, you could argue that the three greatest men of faith in the history of the world would be David, Moses, and Saint Paul. Others would argue, add a few others, but three phenomenal men of faith, David, Moses, and St. Mm-hmm. Paul, they had one other thing in common. They were all murderers.
Mm-hmm.
So here he took three murders to become the three greatest men of faith.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain that, Raphael?
Well, God bless Brother Colson. I'm not sure what his intent was, but it definitely makes for the conversation that the worst thing that you can do in life is take the life of another person. The very worst thing that you can do is to snuff out the very life that God has given to someone else that you had nothing to do with, and you take that from that person. That puts you into a different realm that can either go one or two ways. You can continue to take the life of individuals and become have a rapacious desire to do so, or you can realize the error of your ways and become so empowered with life, so empowered with the idea and concept of improving the lives around you. And I think that those three men are exemplars or paragons of taking the worst thing that you can do in life and changing it into the best thing that you can do, and that save lives and being in the service of other people.
There's a TV evangelist, Dr. Cheryl Stanley, that I think very highly of, In Touch Ministries. He's on a number of times on different stations from the South. And I quote, he says, "Prayer is the most powerful weapon in life."
Absolutely.
What does he mean by that?
Well, prayer is, it's the purification of your heart. It's you talking directly to God, you know. And when God wants to prepare a man or a woman for a particular feat that's insurmountable to the average person, then he have to make sure that particular man and that woman who he has in mind must undergo the most tumultuous circumstance. And it goes back. Those two questions, the one previous and the one now, go hand in hand. Why would God use murderers to be seen as paragons of faith? Because faith have to be as strong as mountains. But in order to get there, you had to have been lowest all our depths. And there's an old saying that he who mastered the valleys attained the highest heights. You can't get high and sustain unless you've been to the lowest depths. And I believe that's the purpose. That's the purpose. I think that's my purpose. I mean, I'm doing some things, but by the grace of God, I would never have thought that I'd be doing some of the things that I'm doing now. And had I not went through what I've been through, and the reality is what it is, and having Johnny Havard in my heart and my mind and in the moral fibers of my muscles, I don't think I would be able to do it. I don't think I would.
Raphael Johnson, you've written three books. Mm-hmm. The first one was To Pose a Threat, My Rite of Passage.
Yes.
Why that name?
I wrote that book when I was in solitary confinement. And all of my life, in hindsight, I was in solitary confinement because I was considered to be a threat to the safety and staff of the institution. I was there in prison because I was deemed to be a threat to society. All of my life, at some form or another, I was deemed to be a threat. And that is the story of most young black men in this society. Whether you're on the positive side or the negative side, there's a threat. There's a form of threat. There's this stigma that you are a threat. And that was my rite of passage, because it made me internalize myself, my qualities, my strengths, my weaknesses, and my potential. To pose a threat was my rite of passage. And ironically, 7 years free, it still is my rite of passage.
James Allen, As a Man Thinketh.
That's
as
right.
Great a book as I've ever read in my life. It's a little, 50-page book, a
if
little
that,
book.
That's right.
What wisdom. And on your website, you have this section, Words to Live By, and you have a little passage of that book. Can you share that with us?
This is a book that I came across probably my fourth year out of 6 years in solitary confinement. And it's a whole lot of quotes that I have. But this one stood out. It helped me accept responsibility for my actions in the past, present, and future. It says, "A man who begins to be a man only begins to be a man when he ceases to whine and revile and commences to search for the hidden justice which regulates his life. And as he adapts his mind to that regulating factor, he ceases to accuse others as the cause of his condition and builds himself up in strong and noble thoughts, ceases to kick against circumstances, but began to use them as aids to his more rapid progress and as a means of discovering the hidden powers and possibilities within himself." And what that means to me is that as a man, you're not going to cry over spilled milk. You're not going to talk about what you could have done and should have done. You're not going to talk about what could have been, what you used to do, and what you were. There's another aphorism that says that man is only responsible for all that he has, all that he looks for, all that he strives for. That's it. And when you embrace that principle, you don't whine. You don't create excuses. You assess the problem. Every problem in mathematics has an answer. Every problem also has a formula. You don't use the same formula in calculus that you would use in trigonometry. You don't use the same formula that you use in division for addition. Every problem has a formula. As a man, you find out what that formula is, and you create the answer.
If there's a listener tonight that's really down and out, huge mistakes, you know, lost the family, et cetera, and he or she says, Raphael, God has given up on me. I'm worthless. What do you say to that listener?
Well, since they evoke the name of God in the book of Hebrews, it says that God will never forsake us. Will never, under any circumstance, forsake us. And the real question is, have you forsaken yourself? Since that is a fact and God never lies, and he says he'll never forsake us, then the question has, how much have you forsaken yourself? And if you're down and out, be glad that you're down and out. Be glad that you can realize that you're down and out, because at the end of the day, you're in the greatest position to pull yourself up. And you're in the greatest position to never repeat or have that particular circumstance repeated again. He who masters the lowest depths attain the greatest heights. You can't be successful and sustain success. This is life. This is a universal principle. Unless you've been through something. Unless you have a story, a unique circumstance. And if the purpose of life is evolution and growth, then grow by the experiences and expressions that God has placed in your path.
As our time winds down tonight, last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners?
Be careful who you call your friends. Because everyone who says that they're your friends are not your friends. There's an old adage that says that true friendship is like diamonds, precious and rare. But false friendship is like autumn leaves. They're found everywhere. Family come first. God, family, friends, associates, and they are enemies. When you categorize the people in your life like that, you'll be successful. We'll have more businesses. We'll have more stores. We'll have more people in college. We'll have less people in jail. God comes first. Family, friends, associates, and your enemies.
Raphael Johnson, if I had a hat on, I'd take it off.
And I'll take mine off right back to you.
You are the epitome of, with God, anything is possible.
Wow, thank you.
Thanks a million. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. God willing.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.
It's true.
Spall.